What is happening tomorrow, Tuesday, and why is it important for you to tell your story?
Well, tomorrow is a hearing up in the courts for the more than a dozen people who've been detained since June 26. The Crown is going to be introducing their evidence in the case. This stunning escalation of legal and police tactics against protesters, a conspiracy case. It really represents a, as I said, an escalation. It represents a criminalization of community organizing and community organizers. That these folks who really are, you know, some great community organizers from places all over Southern Ontario, Toronto, as well as Montreal, that they have to fight for their freedom. And unfortunately, on one level, I'm going to be joining them because I now know that there's a warrant for my arrest for the same charges. So I'll be turning myself in at 5 a.m. today, Tuesday. And I say unfortunately on one level, but I guess on another level, there's no shame to feel, I feel, to be associated with the amazing organizing that these folks do day to day. So this is a place where I've been before, although I have to admit that this clearly is an escalation of their repressive tactics that I didn't expect to be charging people for conspiracy, serious criminal conspiracy charges. But in any case, I'll meet the charges and do so knowing that there's an amazing network of support and solidarity, not just for people who are still on the inside, but for everybody who lived through Police State Toronto over over June 25th, 26th, 27th, and even the 28th. Knowing that there are those strong networks of solidarity and support, that people are looking out for each other, that people are getting self-care, and that people are also fighting to get the prisoners inside out, that's really meaningful. You know, there's a struggle on the outside, and there's a struggle on the inside, and you know, there's a role for both.
Okay, so now this is not the first time the CLAC and other grassroots organizations have experienced police harassment and criminalization. What, in your opinion, is at the heart of these attacks by the government and its security forces against people-centered and anti-globalization groups and movements?
Well, I think a basic tactic, whether you speak about a decade ago or you speak about 2 decades ago, is that, you know, movements are weak when they're in fear and when they're isolated and when they're not together. And they're stronger when we can overcome our fears, when we unite, and when we're together and in solidarity. And one way of creating fear, one way of breaking solidarity is attacking the movement. And that was seen quite physically, and crudely. During the use of these tactics that we saw during the G20 in Toronto, and it's also through the use of the courts. So that's one way to reply to your question. Another one is, you know, there was, people have talked about this unprecedented $1 billion security operation. Well, you know, that results in police repression. That $1 billion security operation results in sound cannon. That $1 billion police operation results in having 18,000 to 19,000 police on the streets of Toronto over a concentrated period of time, but it also means that the police have that much more resources to sort of come up with these charges to get protesters. So what 5 years ago or 10 years ago would simply be seen as organizing is now seen as a conspiracy, some sort of political conspiracy. So the stunning amount of money and resources given to the state security apparatus is one of the reasons why we're seeing this kind of legal intimidation against community organizers.
Now that the summit has wrapped and the delegates have gone home, we are left with the security arsenal and systems in place. Do you think that this escalation in excessive force that we just witnessed, it's something that is just isolated, or is this something that is going to set a precedent in terms of how the government plans to deal with mass dissent in the future?
I can't predict that. I do think at a certain level, the Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair and other people in positions of authority just basically lost the plot over the weekend. What I do think it's important to remind ourselves is that, you know, what did happen over the course of a few days in Toronto was unprecedented in terms of the numbers of people arrested, was brutal in terms of the humiliation that people were forced to suffer. But So it's important to acknowledge that and to sort of reply to that, but doing so in a way that doesn't exceptionalize police violence that we see in poor and marginalized communities, particularly indigenous communities and other communities that have been marginalized every single day. So a lot of us saw a taste of this, in Toronto of police state tactics, but these are tactics that are used all the time. So I don't think there's anything particularly exceptional about that. You know, back in 95, 2 years before the APEC summit, when there was a huge national scandal about police tactics against protesters, the RCMP bragged about smear campaigns against Indigenous sovereignty activists. The RCMP used armed personnel carriers. The RCMP used bullets against protesters. That was in 95. In a few days, we're going to be hitting the anniversary of OCA, the anniversary of the resistance at Kanizutage, and we saw what the state was prepared to do when communities were prepared to resist. So my point there isn't to say that that's what we saw in Toronto necessarily, but my point is that that's part of Canadian history, from the Red River Rebellion to the War Measures Act, from what happened in Gustavson Lake to OCA to the murder of Dudley George at Ipperwash. That's something that is inherent in Canada, and simply what we saw in Toronto was those kinds of police state tactics used routinely against indigenous communities, used routinely against poor and marginalized communities, were deployed against a large population. And so I can't predict if that will happen again. I can say that if we do continue to be effective, we do continue to resist, and we do continue to maintain our solidarity, either the system will give way or it will fight back against that. So that's something we need to be prepared for. I do think one way, though, of preparing ourselves and healing ourselves is building networks of support and solidarity, self-care, collective care, debating strategies and tactics, but doing so in a way where we're doing so as a movement and not playing into divide and rule tactics, which is, I think, a lot of what the police tactics were all about.
It appears from what we witnessed that there was a singling out of people, organizers and activists who are coming from Quebec. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
That is absolutely true. I have heard dozens and dozens of stories from friends and comrades based in Quebec about how they were targeted, whether they were in a car with the Quebec license plate, whether they were staying in an apartment somewhere in Toronto and police entered, that we have video footage of that happening, whether there was a group of people sleeping in a gymnasium on the U of T campus and had police come in, whether people were speaking French and they were youthful or had sort of a protester look where they would wear bandanas and what have you. There was clear profiling and targeting of those activists. And as I said, at some point, Bill Blair lost the plot and had to blame outsiders in a simple way of profiling a certain kind of activist was to go after Francophones from Quebec. So that was clear. And there was particular, anybody who was arrested was subjected to humiliation, but there was, you know, a particular kind of linguistic humiliation being aimed at Quebecois and Quebecois. And what I would add to that is the following. I think part of the fear was, you know, that the community coming in from Quebec and Montreal was well organized and was large in numbers, relatively speaking. You know, when you're organized, you're a target. And that's something we should keep in mind. And groups like CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, have been targeted like that in the past. And although I don't think any of us expected that kind of brazen breach of civil liberties, where literally, if you spoke French and you were in downtown Toronto at a certain point in time, you were going to be searched illegally by the Toronto police. And I just want to, you know, say all that by acknowledging that this is one of many horror stories and one of many stories of police abuse that a lot of people were subjected to. Queer and trans prisoners were humiliated by police inside the jails. Women were subjected to taunts by the police and worse. So it's just part of this great abuse of civil liberties that happened, which I think is clear. You know, that's very clear. But what we need, I think, is to remind ourselves that let's root our responses to those abuses not by simply appealing to, you know, the government institutions that are supposed to correct themselves and talk about how to improve policing, but rather question the inherent repressive nature of policing in and of itself, and how policing is completely necessary and integral to this economic agenda, right? Because Police State Toronto, the repressive apparatus of Toronto was happening before our very eyes. Meanwhile, behind the fences, the G20 leaders agreed to pass these austerity measures. And that's a nice little word there, austerity. But what that means is extreme violence in the day-to-day lives of billions of people whose social programs are going to be cut, subsidies to basic goods will be cut. That's what austerity means. There was a massive shift of wealth from the poor to the rich, implemented with austerity, promoted by people like Jim Flaherty, the Canadian finance minister who used to be part of Mike Harris's Common Sense Revolution. So that economic violence that was undertaken behind smiles and world leaders watching the World Cup was accompanied by the political violence on the streets. And the only reason that violence showed itself was that people were willing to take those streets and assert themselves on the streets, and that was a good thing. And what we need to do now, I think, is continue to regroup a bit and support ourselves so that we can meet this challenge that Police State Toronto pushed down our throats.
What do you think it's important for the general public to know and keep in mind as the judicial system prepares to prosecute those who are facing G20-related charges?
Well, I always like to say that what the focus should be on is not necessarily guilt or innocence, but rather how we struggle together and how we fight. So that's something I guess I would aim not necessarily at the general public, but at people who are part of this movement and active on issues of social and economic and ecological justice. What I would add for the general public is that what's happening in the courtroom with lawyers and judges is simply another manifestation of what was happening in the streets. It's going to look a lot more official, and it's going to look a lot more, tidy than getting a rubber bullet shot at you or being put in a cage, but it's another manifestation of that. And I think that should be kept in mind. The people who are remaining in prison, me going in early this morning, we're all community organizers. We come from spaces that are rooted in day-to-day organizing, fighting against all kinds of injustices with people. We're accountable to those communities, and we should be back in those communities. And instead, what's happening is that we're being ripped away from those communities and those struggles on escalated, exaggerated charges that simply aim to criminalize protesters and criminalize community organizers.
Before we let you go, do you have any parting thoughts or a message that you want to send out to those who are listening to this interview?
Well, I have a mixture of emotions, and I think all of them are valid. I'm very inspired and exhilarated by a lot of what I saw in Toronto and subsequently with the support networks. I'm also angry and enraged at the humiliations that people were forced to suffer. I am also a bit worried at what's going to happen to friends and comrades and myself as well. And I think all of those emotions are just part of what go into a struggle. It's just a matter of channeling them all in the most productive and creative ways. And I think right now that would be to, first of all, keep our eyes on the prize, which is the day-to-day organizing we do all the time. I always feel that the best kind of support that people can do for me when I'm inside is continue that organizing that we do, in our communities and in the streets and in our neighborhoods. And so to maintain that and to continue that, because, we gather together in Toronto, but we came from places that we're accountable to. And secondly, do support the people inside. Take the time to learn who they are as people, not the caricatures and the smears we're going to hear inevitably in the corporate media and by the police with regards to people and their intentions and what have you. I think those are two messages I guess I want to share with folks.